Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. Every market bubble begins with a good idea and ends with unrealistic expectations. Truer words have probably never been said. I'm Jim Mwea. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest announcement by Tiger Wheel and Tyre saying that they've entered into a transaction to have the entire business bought out by a Japanese shareholder. We're going to be taking a look at that and trying to make sense of what that transaction could potentially mean for that business. We also have a conversation with the Chief Executive Officer at Alex Forbes, Davi de Villiers, taking a look at the results from Alex Forbes. They reported their year-end financial results. We're going to take a look at their performance and make sense of it if we have a conversation with Standard Bank's Jacques Else, taking a look at the market or the world of high net worth individuals and what it is that they look at from an investment standpoint. And then we've got a special World Cup conversation, taking a look at this particular World Cup, taking a look at the commercials behind it. The team at Allianz Trade have put together a report that suggests that this particular World Cup could generate a little over $9 billion for the three host countries combined. We're going to take a look at that report and see if we can figure out how that number was arrived at. Then we've got a conversation as part of our Thursday conversations of small businesses. We love profiling small businesses. This week we look at a company called Cloudy Deliveries, and get a sense of what it is that they do.
The day's markets, understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
As always, that's where we kick off the show with a sense of market movements. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, Nick Kunze, to take a look at markets and see what they've been up to. Nicholas, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. I noted that the Rand, just before you and I came on air, dipped below all of the key levels against the major currencies, below 22 against the British pound, 19 against the euro, and even below 16.50 against the US dollar. Nice to see some bit of strength on a Thursday, particularly on the currency front.
Yes, evening, Jimmy. Evening to the listeners. Always nice to be on a green day. I guess the headline was interesting. I mean, you know, we sort of had this headline number about Iran declaring the Straits of Hormuz effectively closed. And despite all of that, you know, JC actually closed firmer. You mentioned the Rand. Nice day on the Rand as well. Our bonds as well. We don't often look at the bonds. Bonds were slightly up as well. JSU was up. And I suspect slightly not just the shares that sort of gave it a bit of a push or the risk on attitude. I think it was also, there was a quite a nice current account deficit number that came out showing that that South Africa actually posted its largest current account surplus in more than 4 years. That was in Q1, all to do with everyone seeking the gold exports that we send out. So, you know, as much as there's lots going on in the geopolitics, still a bit of good news coming out of SA.
Nick, let's look at the rest of the markets. You mentioned it was a green day, and I'm looking at equity markets by and large, almost all of them in the green, with the exception, of course, of markets in Asia, but they didn't have the benefit of trading through some of the news points or the data points that you alluded to just now. I want to get your thoughts on some of the sentiment. It still seems to be up and down, one day on, one day off, one day green, one day red. Markets perhaps still very nervous about all of the factors that they still have to contend with globally.
Yeah, I mean, very, very nervous markets. I mean, just look back, Jimmy, the last sort of 5 days, effectively. I mean, since the start of the week, even. I mean, you know, coming in, the Taiwanese market, the KOSPI, which has been quite a big proxy for risk because of the overweight in the semiconductors. You know, they've got Samsung and SK Hynix, etc. So that was limit down, followed through from Wall Street last Friday. We had that tech sell-off. Monday, they were limit down. I mean, it was 8% in the index down. Closed the market for 20 minutes. All is forgotten by Tuesday. The market was, in fact, limit up 8%, closed it on the upside. I mean, that kind of sums up where we are, just these wild swings every single day. Difficult to make head or tail of it, quite honestly. And I think there's a little bit of, I guess, Iran, Trump fatigue coming through as well. These headlines that keep coming out. Markets is sort of, I guess, looking through it a little bit. And everyone's like super excited for tomorrow, because tomorrow we've got the SpaceX. So, you know, there's something else, I guess, to focus on for the time being.
Nick, let's look into that in a bit more detail. I know that's, well, at this point, based on the numbers, it's probably going to be the biggest IPO in history. But I want to get your thoughts around the IPO itself. Is it sustainable? Are we looking at the numbers wrong? Are we just looking for some bit of excitement in the market? What are your thoughts around the IPO and the valuations that have been thrown out there?
You know what I think? I mean, first and foremost, you know, I think, I mean, this is the biggest bet of on the AI play, on the future, and all sorts. And you know, the Musk, you know, the followers of Mr. Musk, and the, you know, the ardent sort of believers in his prophecies, whether they come true or not, will still be there. And interesting enough, speaking of this IPO, I see about 30% is going to be going to the retail investor. I mean, that's effectively unheard of. Normally, the sort of big banks, and there's 21 sort of lead underwriters in this. And as you said, Jimmy, this is the biggest IPO in history. This is going to dwarf Saudi Aramco, which was the last one of a, not even close to the size, but it was the second biggest. And I think, you know, it does sum up the, I guess, the mood of the current environment. You know, this AI sort of trade that's been happening for the last couple of months. You know, they're all rushing to get there. I guess myself, with a bit of, I don't know, history in this business, you know, it does, I don't say it's necessarily the top of the market, but when there's a big rush of IPOs of this massive scale, it normally does signify that markets are looking a little bit heated. You know, everyone rushing out to get their money out there. And there's only so much to go around, right? I mean, if you've got IPOs of this scale, I mean, that's probably why you're seeing some of this other assets sell off. People having to sell other assets to buy into these IPOs. Doesn't necessarily mean the market's going to turn around and crash, but it certainly does, you know, history as a guide. You know, when these big things do come to the market, it is a sign that you know, insiders are realizing it's time to maybe take some money off the table. That's about as eloquent I can put it, Jimmy.
Nick, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on the gold price. Definitely money coming off the table there. The gold price back at $4,000 a fine ounce. We saw 5,000 at some point. We came down. We were all surprised at a deep correction back to 4,400. But we're even deeper than that now, potentially even staring down the barrel of sub 4,000. What do you make of that?
I think, again, I mean, I hate to ratchet in this the space says conversation. I think a lot of the winners of the past, people have been selling out to get free up some capital. I think that's gold's probably reciprocant of it. The war in Iran, ironically, despite, you know, most of us thinking, well, surely that's good for gold. The likes of Turkey, who have been net buyers of gold, for example, have been selling a lot of their holdings the last few months, and openly so, on the back of the idea they need to rearm, if the fact that America pulls out of NATO, etc. So all the original central bank buyers, which was the positive tailwind that we had over the last few years, they are actually sort of selling at the moment. So that's the one argument there. And then, of course, I mean, we've had a couple of very nervous inflation numbers. I mean, look at Friday's non-farm payroll number, you know, huge jump in jobs. I'm sure you guys spoke about it this week. You know, that's obviously pushed out the fact that there's actually not going to be interest rate cuts in America. There's going to be interest rate rises are coming, certainly by the end of the year, where that CPR print in America, that inflation print, biggest jump in about 3 years as well. I mean, that CPR print, I think it came in 4.2 or 4% thereabouts. I mean, that's double the Fed's target of 2%. So all these things are not good for the gold bugs out there. And that's more than likely why you're seeing off. I mean, at some point, it will find a little bit of a flaw and we see a little bit of dollar weakness coming in. But for now, it's just, you know, it's on the back end of all those sort of bad anti-gold news headlines that we've had in the last couple of weeks.
Markets continue to be dizzying, and trying to make sense of them might leave you with a bigger headache than anything else. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note. We'll take the positive win that is a green day, and we'll see what tomorrow holds. Nicholas Kunz, the Sanlam Private Wealth Portfolio Manager, joining us to take a look at markets and try and make sense of them.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So earlier today, I saw probably one of the most unexpected headlines that hit the market, and it was that a Japanese company by the name of Marubeni Corporation had acquired 100% of a company called TI Auto Investments, along with all of its retail chains. Now, TI Auto Investments, for those that don't know, the retail chains we're referring to here, that is the Tiger Wheel and Tire brands. They've been acquired by the Japanese conglomerate. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with our resident M&A expert, managing director at Deal Leaders International, Andrew Ballman. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Andrew, always lovely having you on the show. Always lovely catching up over these interesting conversations. This, quite the interesting development, quite the interesting announcement. What do you make of it?
Hi, Jimmy. Yeah, good to touch base again. Yeah, look, it's exciting. I think whenever there's an international capital deployment like this, it just shows that there, in amongst all the other challenges, there is opportunity. Have dealt with Marubeni in the past, and it is a very large company in multiple industries. So yeah, really good to see this play, and it seems like they are going to treat it like a strategic platform for growth. So I think all in all, really good. Obviously there's quite a lot of runway up ahead for them to get it through, the necessary approvals and the likes. But all in all, I think very, very positive, and I'm sure a good exit for Altera and Old Mutual as well.
Andrew, I want to get your thoughts and get a sense of these types of transactions. You mentioned it's always good to see international capital come in. This isn't the first time we've seen this happen. Most recently, the example that jumps to mind is the sale of AfriSam to a Chinese conglomerate. What does that say about, number one, the attractiveness of South African companies? Because you and I have spoken about this in the past, to say that South African companies are not only resilient, but they are well built. And clearly this is playing out.
Yeah, it really is. I think, I recall one of our conversations in the past was, we always dealt with, the country risk element. I think globally risk has changed fundamentally. So yeah, I think we lose sight that there are fundamentally strong and robust South African businesses and groups. And, if you look at these, particularly these multinational investors, if we are attracting capital, with this TI Auto example, it shows that there is definitely something here, and hopefully it will continue to do so. And there are large transactions, and hopefully they translate into growth transactions. But I always say we've got to compete, for capital, and it's a big world out there. But clearly, in certain sectors, there's appetite, and hopefully we continue to do certain things right.
Andrew, let's take a look at the value proposition this then presents for a company like TI Auto, for the retail outlets that are associated with this particular transaction. You've now got a new parent company. You have to continue operating from a business perspective. The likes of Old Mutual Private Equity and Altera Capital, as you mentioned, have exited this transaction. But what does a new chapter signal for potential growth prospects, potential next chapter conversations, if you are being taken over?
I think the starting point always is, it's a player like Marubeni comes with patient capital. So unlike your traditional private equity play, there's no timeline on the capital investment that would be available for growth. I think what also would be exciting would be Marubeni's pedigree, if you like, and experience in building, large platforms like a Tiger Wheel and Tire, because they've done so very successfully. They bought an asset in Thailand called BeQuick. And it started, you know, when they got it at 44 stores and they built it to 241. They replicated that in Indonesia and did the same in Mexico. So there's track record there that you know, they can grow this. And you can definitely see, you know, I was reading earlier that, you know, they originally were distributing OEM, I think it was Toyota and Hino, out of Ghana. And it seems like they've now moved into this multi-dimensional OEM aftermarket play. And they're seeing this as the platform. So I think, you know, they bring pedigree, they bring experience, they'll bring buying power, they'll bring capital and probably IP capital as well. And real experience in developing markets, you know. So it's not like they've got, you know, only experience in first world or Japan, you know, the markets that they've gone into, like a Mexico and Indonesia and Thailand, they aren't easy markets either. So, you know, I think they're going to come here with eyes wide open, and they definitely, you know, having dealt with them in the past, they definitely would have done their homework, you know, and this would have been a decision that's taken a long time to reach.
Andrew, before I let you go, I want to take a look at what this means for other businesses that might not be listed businesses, but that might be big enough to consider exits at this stage. Surely this gives confidence that, and hope that, if you find the right investor, you find the right exit strategy. It doesn't always mean that the only way to exit businesses or to realize value is in listing, even though we will always welcome new listings on our local bourse.
Yeah, look, definitely. I think more and more, you know, listing is the exception. You know, I think the key always is who is that next buyer, like a Marubeni. And, you know, it's one of the pillars we built our business on. You know, they are out there. And I think what is key also is to understand what the buyer's strategy looks like years before they buy you, so you can almost align to that. So, yeah, very, very exciting. And the opportunities continue because the capital is out there, and we got to just, you know, be that capital magnet. And, you know, more transactions like this will put us on the map, and it'll show hopefully that it's not that difficult to do successful, solid transactions in this part of the world.
Doing good deals is not the problem. Finding good businesses is seemingly growing as a problem that investors are being confronted with. But from a South African perspective, we'll just keep building them. Someone else will come in and buy them. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Andrew Bowman, Managing Director at Deal Leaders International, joining us to take a look at the latest Tiger Wheel and Tiger acquisition transaction and what it says about South African businesses.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Alexander Forbes Group Holdings Limited released their year-end results for the financial year ended 31 March 2026. There is a special dividend in place. There is revenue growth. There is operating income growth. And we're going to be taking a look at all of these moving parts with the company's Group Chief Executive Officer, Davi de Villiers. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of their performance. Davi, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. When last you and I spoke, we had more than $1 billion in cash and we needed to spend it. How did the year go?
Thanks for having me, Jimmy. It was an excellent year. We were blessed with some tailwinds, obviously, from the markets. Lots of volatility, but really an excellent year from our side, specifically execution. You know, I love it when you have a plan and you can actually execute on it, and then it comes to fruition. You know, then you pull through the whole value chain, and it felt like this year it was one of those years. So really, really proud of the year.
Let's take a look at some of those moving parts, Davi. The year has been filled with a myriad of market challenges, some operational conversations around how you've been looking at your business. The business remains highly cash generative. Take me through kind of the portfolios and how you saw the performances of your asset management business versus what was happening in the market.
100%. You know, you talked about cash, and we're always very cash generative, and we try and pay, you know, the free cash out in dividends. We're a dividend stock. Our dividend yield's about 7%. So, you know, we pay the available cash out, and there's cash balances that change. This last year, you know, we paid a special dividend, as you rightfully said, after the cash. So that makes the available cash a little bit less this year. But, you know, you generate new cash and then you pay that out as a dividend. So all in the ordinary course of events, very, very good, very good. What drove the underlying results was kind of threefold. You know, the one, the markets help. About 50% of our revenue is dependent on markets and asset-based, and the markets gave us a blended return where cash and bonds and equities and all of that gave us a return of about 16% on half of our revenue. So that was wonderful and a great tailwind, you know, contrary to the previous 10 years. So that was wonderful to be in the asset management space during this year. And then the other half driver is new business. We had record new business again. But what was different this year is with the new business, we've now gotten to a relatively positive stage in finding net new business, you know, so it's adding to the bottom line of assets and revenue, which is great as well. We're in a business, you know, of paying death claims, paying annuities. So there's a lot of normal outflows, but the new business now surpassed that. And then lastly, the revenue from the retail business. You know, we've been talking about retail the whole time. And in our sense, retail is just helping individual save as well, like we help corporates. And that business is also now at a stage where it's contributing nicely. I mean, the new business on that business was up 39%, 36 billion of assets under management added to the bottom line. So really, the combination of those three adding to the revenue and the growth, you know, which is a wonderful place to be.
Mdavi, speaking of the growth, the business now sits north of 730 odd billion rands in total assets. We're nearing that trillion rand mark. And with the growth, the business has taken the decision to keep shareholders in the loop with that special dividend. Take me through that balancing. Take me through having cash on hand, growing assets, finding a special dividend in a time where many companies are struggling, many asset managers might be struggling, and markets are very clearly unforgiving.
Yes. So just to be clear, the special dividend was last year, or, you know, and that was on the cash that we had on hand when we spoke last time. So not again, because we don't have extra cash this time. But you're right. In concept, you're 100% right. We're trying to grow. The biggest expense and thinking of use of capital is obviously for acquisitions. And when we find those, we have the ability to gear because our balance sheet is basically clean, you know, so we have the ability to gear. So we don't have to keep cash at low returns on the balance sheet in order to wait for possible acquisition. So that's a great position to be in. And the other spending is on tech development and AI now taking center stage in that as well. So, and that we're doing in the course of events. In any case, we're spending money on tech as and when is needed, and that might eat a little bit into the capital. But certainly we're on a growth phase. Which come back to your question, we continuously will invest in systems and we will continuously try and grow our business. But a big part of the growth is actually getting new business, not necessarily, you know, through acquiring and or, you know, adding stuff. It's really about getting new business, getting market share in our space. So a balancing act, but for us, a real focus on developing the existing business to be better and more efficient.
Mdavi, going into the new year, I want to get your thoughts on how the business is looking at the market. I mean, we've got huge conversations taking place around AI and hyperscaling businesses. I imagine that presents its own unique sets of opportunities for a business like Alex Forbes that doesn't necessarily rely on any particular sector to generate its revenue, but rather just looks for good businesses and good investment opportunities. How do you then approach the new financial year, given that everything is consistently changing in the market and nothing seems to be certain?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. You know, it's certainly an environment that is changing and changing fast. So, you know, if you can't adapt and can't adapt to, you know, client needs firstly, and then the environment in which you operate and how you invest money and how cash flows are managed, you know, then you won't be successful. So I think the pressure is on. Certainly our business and other businesses to stay with this changing environment. With the changing environment, Jimmy, I must also say, you know, it brings opportunities. And we're excited about that. AI brings a lot of risks, you know, cyber risk increases tenfold because of the enhancement in AI. But also AI brings opportunities for us to not only, you know, marginally increase your business, but transform it in certain areas, you know. And the efficiencies that you can get there and or the engagement with the the clients in the market can transform a business. So we must just capture the right opportunities quickly enough and have the right impact. So I think it's an exciting time to be alive. It doesn't make it easier. It puts stress on, but it's an exciting time to be in business, to be in our business. We love the stress that, you know, the client needs and the client demands put on us, because it needs to, you know, we need to evolve and do the right thing. But as I said, the opportunity there is, if you're good at it and you win, relative, it's a relative game in South Africa. That we're still waiting for the actual growth, the gross growth in South Africa. So at the moment, when everything's flat, you have to win relative to others, you have to win market share. So we must strive to be the best, not just to be average. You must be the best in order to win market share. So I think there's lots of opportunities, and we certainly looking forward to capture some of them.
Ever the optimist and always looking for the next opportunity, the team at Alex Forbes seemingly having a much better time of the market. I suppose that is the product of the hard work that gets put in throughout the year. You get the benefit of enjoying the results come the end of the year. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Chief Executive Officer at Alexander Forbes Group Holdings, David de Villiers, joining us to reflect on the financial year that was, where the business stands and what the business is looking ahead to.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. With all the World Cup hype, many individuals might be wondering if they can attend matches. Many might want or wish to attend matches. But there's also a group of individuals that are known as high net worth individuals, ultra high net worth individuals, that are already attending the matches. Those that have flown out to go and watch the World Cup and get a front row seat. We're going to be taking a look at this landscape, this high net worth and ultra high net worth landscape, trying to make sense of how it is that it comes about. And joined on the line by the head of wealth and investment at Standard Bank South Africa, Jacques Els, to take a look at what it is that they look after as a portfolio. Jacques, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. We've seen quite a bit of growth in the high net worth and ultra high net worth spaces, particularly in the African markets. I know that there's a couple of good reports that give us an indication of that growth, but we've also seen with the performances of markets that this is not an uncommon thing. What differentiates Africa's high net worth market from other markets?
First of all, thank you very much for having me. We are, I think, in some of the most exciting times in Africa as it relates to high net worth or ultra high net worth families at the moment. I think the key distinguishing factor between Africa and perhaps the West, be that America, Europe, or the Far East, is really the fact that in Africa, the majority of wealth that's being created at the moment is first-generation wealth. In United States, in Western Europe, to some extent Eastern Europe, and in certain parts of Asia, I think the concept of multi-generational wealth is a lot more well established, where you've got third, fourth, fifth, and subsequent generations currently benefiting from wealth that have been created many, many years ago. In Africa, it's a much younger trend. We have a lot more entrepreneurs in Africa, I think, at the moment than what we had perhaps 10, 20 years ago. So in Africa is predominantly first-generation wealth that we are seeing emerging at the moment, as opposed to, like I said, multi-generational in other parts of the world.
Jacques, let's take a look at how this wealth is built and how it comes about. I can imagine, again, here we might be talking about things that look different to other parts of the world, maybe not as many inherited businesses, maybe new startups or different driving factors as to how Africa's high net worth individuals are created and maintained.
Let me perhaps talk first about some of the commonalities and differences between Africa and other parts of the world. And then I'll talk about three specific what we call archetypes of people that are creating wealth. But firstly, I think in one respect, Africa's high net worth and ultra high net worth is similar to those in other parts of the world, in the sense that key to them is the security of their children and their families. Where it differs in Africa is, I think, given various nuances across Africa, in the case of African high net worth ultra high net worth individuals, I think there's a sharper awareness of geopolitical risk, currency volatility, and infrastructure uncertainty than perhaps in other parts of the world. So in some respects, Africa's ultra-high wealthy is the same as other parts of the world. And in other respects, like I said, I think there are perhaps some differences given our geopolitical background. In terms of the types of people that generate wealth, we have, in a recent report, highlighted three different archetypes. The first is entrepreneurs, people that have built up businesses over time, We have people that continue managing one business line for many, many years. We have other people that build businesses, they sell businesses, they start up and build more businesses. But I would say entrepreneurs probably form half of the high net worth and ultra high net worth that we deal with across Africa. The second archetype is what we call the corporate grafter. And these are individuals that have built corporate careers, often over quite a prolonged period of time, that end up in the C-suite at many of the corporates, and that build up wealth over their careers. In many instances, this wealth is to be found in equity positions that these individuals build up over time, and they obviously over time liquidate these positions, building up wealth until they ultimately exit the corporate world. The third of the archetypes is what we call the legacy steward, and that is perhaps taking us to the longer term generational wealth component. These are patriarchs and matriarchs to whom it is not as important to generate wealth, but the most important for these individuals are to protect wealth and ultimately transfer that wealth to subsequent generations. So in the case of a legacy steward, I would say there's a lower risk tolerance than what you might find in the case of an entrepreneur, who are normally your fast movers, they are agile, and they often have very high risk tolerances. Where in the case of legacy steward, I think wealth preservation is the overriding importance there.
Jacques, in the current climate we find ourselves in the current markets we find ourselves in, with all the uncertainty that is out there, what do you think keeps high net worth individuals awake at night from their own perspectives? Understanding that some of those things might look very different to what keeps the average person awake at night.
Correct. I think first and foremost is succession. For the majority of high net worth and ultra high net worth families, one of the overriding factors is legacy. What is the legacy they can leave for subsequent generations? And legacy ties right back with succession. In the case of family enterprises in particular, it is one of the key concerns for business owners is who will take over the family business. In many instances, we have subsequent generations taking over the family businesses. We also see instances where the next generations aren't particularly either interested or in some instances capable of taking over the family businesses. So succession, I think, is a very, very important factor that keeps these families awake at night. Along with that is family fragmentation. We are finding ourselves in an increased, I think, global society where families often physically fragment. The family members go all over the world. They study in certain places. They put down roots in other places. But also from a cohesion perspective, and going back to the family enterprise concept I spoke about, families are often very concerned that they might not be able to keep the family together in a certain sense. From an economic perspective, I think not so much given the African context at the moment, but given the global context, currency depreciation and geopolitical risk, I think those are also two very serious concerns for our clients. And then I think at the bottom, if I can call it, of the pyramid of concerns is wealth preservation for subsequent generations. Like I said earlier, in certain instances, at first generation wealth being created. In other instances, we're dealing with fifth or sixth generation wealth that's being protected. But the overriding concern for high net worth families is how can they protect their wealth? How can they grow their wealth? But ultimately, how can they preserve it and transfer it to subsequent generations? That intergenerational wealth transfer is, I think, the central point to the lives of our clients.
Perhaps some different daily concerns, some different schedules and planning, but one thing is certain, even with high net worth individuals and how it is that they navigate their lives at a time like this, some of these conversations might take a bit of a backseat as we all celebrate what is currently happening in Mexico, the kickoff of the World Cup imminent, and Standard Bank, of course, the lead sponsor at that. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Jacques Alves, the head of wealth and investment at Standard Bank South Africa, joining us to take a look at the world of high net worth individuals and what keeps them up at night. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in UCount Rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search UCount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So with the FIFA World Cup set to kick off today in a couple of hours, probably even less than a couple of hours at this stage, thought we'd take a look at what this potentially means for the host countries of this year's World Cup. We already know the states of these economies in the form of the United States, Mexico and Canada, but we're going to take a bit of a deeper dive into what could potentially be the result of a World Cup across three countries. I'm joined on the line by the sector advisor at Allianz Trade, Maria Latore, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Maria, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Now, you and the team at Allianz have put together quite an interesting report that suggests that the FIFA World Cup this year could potentially provide almost $9 billion to the North American GDPs across the three countries. How did you arrive at that number? That's quite an interesting number.
Yes. Hello, Jimmy. Thanks for inviting me. Well, from a macroeconomic perspective, sporting events entail four types of spending which impact the GDP growth of the domestic economy. So the first one is, of course, foreign tourism spending. The second one is domestic tourism spending. The third one is security public administration spending, which is mostly government consumption. And the fourth is infrastructure spending infrastructure investments. So in all, this event is expected to generate around $9.1 billion of GDP boost between June and July across the three nations. So the US is expected to capture the vast majority of the economic benefits simply because it hosts the majority of matches, 78 out of 104 matches in total. So relative to its economy, the effects will be small. So for the US, we estimate a GDP lift of around $6.1 billion, followed then by Mexico with a gain of $1.7 billion. And the last beneficiary will be Canada with a GDP boost of around $1.3 billion. So in terms of quarterly non-annualized GDP growth, which is mostly falling on Q3, this is expected to represent a boost of 0.1 percentage point above a counterfactual without FIFA World Cup in the US, a boost of 0.3 percentage point in Mexico, and 0.2 percentage point in Canada. So in a relative view, in a relative perspective, it's not that huge, the economic boost of this sporty event.
Maria, when we compare these numbers that are projected, obviously we don't know what the end result will be because the World Cup hasn't yet taken place. But when we look at these numbers versus what we know from previous World Cups, where does this rank this particular World Cup?
Well, I would say that the main difference this time is the fact that this World Cup is going to test whether a World Cup can successfully evolve from a single country event into a distributed continental experience without sacrificing atmosphere, attendance, or commercial performance. So we are going to see or to witness something different, which is the fact that now we are including more nationalities this time. We are expanding from 32 to 48 teams and from 64 to 104 matches across 16 host cities and in three different countries. So this is going to be like an unprecedented event. So expectations are that in terms of TV viewers and in terms of stadium attendance, numbers are going to be higher. Still, this is, as you mentioned, the event has not started yet, so we cannot fully said what is going to be the real outcome of the attendance. But yeah, normally this World Cup has the capacity to host around 6.5 million attendants, considering that all the stadiums have on average a capacity of 65,000 people per stadiums, and assuming that all of them can be full at around 85 to 90% of their capacity.
Maria, I want to look at something that you touched on. You mentioned that when you measure the GDP impact of World Cups, you looked at a couple of factors, one of them being international tourism, the other being domestic tourism. You mentioned those as two separate factors, but I want to zoom in on the international tourism aspect of it. Leading up to this tournament, we've seen various reports around hotels and accommodations being half booked, match tickets being expensive. We haven't really seen the international uptick that might have been with other World Cups that have happened before. And alongside that, we've also seen most recently the likes of the United States making it exceptionally difficult for those that want to attend the World Cup to get in and out of America, from everything from visas to all of the other logistical arrangements around that. Do you think that that will have a significant impact on the international tourism aspect of the GDP we're expecting to grow here?
Well, there are some early signs of uneven demand, but it's still early to say that the hospitality upside is overstated for this six-week event. For major global events like the World Cup, ticket sales and hotel bookings typically accelerate closer to match dates and are highly concentrated in key cities and fixtures. What we are more likely seeing is not a weaker overall outlook, but a more uneven distribution of demand across time and cities. So the hospitality sector should still see a meaningful uplift, but it will be more selective and match-driven than uniform across all cities. In Mexico, for example, a weaker exchange rate, lower entry or border barriers, as you were mentioning, and the stronger football culture of the country are attracting more tourists. So in contrast, for example, we are seeing so far that in Canada, where more limited hotel capacities is likely to drive higher room prices, or in the US, for example, where stricter visa requirements may also deter some international visitors. But yeah, as you were mentioning, international visitors is an important boost for this GDP lift that these countries are going to experience. In our calculations, in our assumptions, tourism spending itself is expected to increase by $8 billion in North America in total, largely dominated by foreign spending, as I was saying. So indeed, the split is expected to be $6.8 billion in tourism export, this is foreign tourism spending, and then $1.2 billion in household consumption or domestic tourism spending. Then if we look by country, the split of the tourism spending benefit will be $5.4 billion of gains for the United States, $1.4 billion for Mexico, and $1.2 billion for Canada. And so if we look now, or if we go now to a sector level, the lodging sector is positioned to be among the clearest beneficiaries of the tournament, although outcome will vary considerably by city. For example, New York, Miami, Los Angeles, Dallas, and even San Francisco, those cities possess extensive hotel inventories and significant experience hosting large-scale international events. So these cities are likely to absorb demand relatively efficiently, while in contrast, cities such as, for example, Seattle or Vancouver, they may face more meaningful capacity constraints. Then if we continue with the sector angle, we have airlines, which are also clear winners of this tournament, supported by the constrained capacity, but also from their strong pricing power right now. But this is more a temporary event-driven boost than a structural improvement in the profitability of the sector overall. And then the sector of food and beverage will also benefit from strong but localized demand, specifically in fan zones or in match cities. And then, of course, the largest gain will also go to global TV media with broadcasting rights and advertising generating a lot of revenue as well for these companies.
So clearly there will be winners and losers in this World Cup regardless of its outcome, and we'll look forward to seeing how that shapes up or what that outcome does indeed look like as the World Cup kicks off in a couple of minutes at this point. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Maria Latorre, the sector advisor at Allianz Trade, joining us to take a look at their report that suggests that this World Cup could potentially add $9 billion to North American GDP.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
SME of the Week is powered by Capitec Business Banking. Start out or scale up with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply. It is SME of the Week time, and we get to spotlight small businesses and showcase those businesses to you, our SAFM community. This week's small business is a company called Cloudy Deliveries. I'm joined on the line by the company's co-founder, Sive Tabuko, to take a look at that business and get a sense of what it is that they do. Sive, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about Cloudy Deliveries. What is it that you guys do? I'm guessing you're in the delivery game.
Yes. Hi. Hello, Jimmy. Hope you're good. Yes, we are a delivery service in logistics sense. We do deliveries for local restaurants, for supermarkets, and just other general stores within the community. And we use bicycles. So our service is similar to Uber, to your Uber.
How did this business come about, Sive?
Yes. So how the business came about was when my partner, Colin, when he was at home, he was studying, doing his schoolwork, and he wanted to get some stuff from the store. And, you know, he thought it would be great if you are doing something, you are focusing on whatever you're doing, whether you're cooking, and you just want to focus, and you can be able to send someone to the store. And or wherever you want to send them, give them a list, and they can go and get it for you and bring it at your doorstep. And we thought, you know, bicycles would be great for efficiency. And this was in 2020, right before the COVID started.
How did you navigate COVID, Sive? Surely that must have been a challenging time as a new business.
Yes, of course, it was. I mean, when COVID hit, because when we started, we really had no clue, you know, it was going to be a thing. And when COVID hit, it also affected us as well, like everyone else, especially for a small business like us as we're starting. So it really became a huge problem. But at the early stages, we quickly, you know, realized that this was another huge opportunity for us. So instead of closing down, we tried to get a permit from the government, which we managed to get. And that permit had allowed us to operate like other essential businesses. And that's really where our business started to catch traction. People started using our service a lot at the time. And especially, you know, knowing that a lot of people are losing their jobs at that time, and for us to have this business, this project to work forward to look towards every day, really, really meant a lot for us, for the guys that we worked with, and being able to put some food on the table.
Sive, take me through the balance between logistics and groceries. I mean, from a business perspective, you touched on how the business was built, but I know that along the way, delivering parcels also became part of Cloudy Deliveries' identity. Take me through how easy it was or how difficult it might have been to add that and to pivot into offering more services.
Yeah. Our main objective, you know, was mainly to deliver parcels for customers, groceries from supermarkets to their homes. But we had seen that people were starting to request us to do certain things for them. And it became something common when someone is asking you, can you go do this? Can you take this parcel and deliver it there? And that allowed us to actually see that, oh, there's actually more we can offer instead of just sticking to one thing. And that's where we saw, okay, let's expand our services and do errands for customers instead of just doing grocery delivery. Where now we deliver their packages, we deliver their laundry, the laundry store, and we also now go into supermarkets to do their shopping for them. So it's not just collecting the shopping from the store. The customer can be able to send us to the supermarkets, and we do their entire groceries and deliver to their home.
Siva, how do you build trust with your customers? I can imagine that becomes very important when you are doing something on behalf of someone, especially if those tasks involve financial remunerations. How do you maintain trust with your clients, and how do you operate from a business perspective where it relates to these transactions?
Yes, that's really important. Trust is really important. And one of the ways that we do it, we, for example, with the brand that we've built throughout the years, people, when it's easy for them to recognize us, to feel that if anything would happen, they know exactly where to report and this issue will be solved. And the fact that we work with people from the community, and not that we're close to anyone who's outside, but when someone sees also a familiar face, that as well helps a lot. It does really build trust. When you know that you know this person, they look familiar, even though you've never spoken to them. And the brand that we've built throughout the years, people are able to trust us and know exactly where to find us if anything would happen. And customer service is really, really important. And customer service really comes in when things go bad, and that's it. After a horrible experience with the customer, and you are able to solve that issue, that's where they start actually to really, really trust you.
Siva, take us through what lies ahead for the business. I see you guys have some good affiliations and partners that you collaborate with. Take us through how you're growing the business and taking it to its next chapter.
We would really love to take what we have here in Langa and find ways to cut and paste it into other locations, whether it's in the city, the suburban areas, but we really want to be intentional into moving into townships that are just like Langa, because that's where we know we'll have a huge impact, where this kind of service is really, really not available in these type of townships. And as well as you mentioned, to try and find ways to partner as much as we can with other bigger companies where we can be their last mile deliveries, especially for townships, because most people don't receive, even the big companies don't deliver in these townships. You'd have to go collect your parcel at a local police station or something like that. But if we would get the chance to actually partner with these big companies, and it would really help us a lot as well to grow the business.
Siva, what's the best part about running a township business? What do you enjoy the most in you and your team?
What we enjoy the most is knowing that you have an impact within the space that you operate in. You have a huge positive impact. And as well as working with the people that we work with, working with the community that we work with, really does bring joy to us. And when you know that you really have an impact, not just in someone else's life, but in their family as well, that really does bring joy to us.
Siva, before I let you go, where do people get hold of your business? Give us the details around where you guys are based, located. Give us all the online information, how people reach out to you if they want to make use of your services.
Yeah. One of the ways they're able to, you can find us on our social media platforms, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram. It's all Cloudy Deliveries. And as well as on our WhatsApp, on our WhatsApp bot, which we use to receive deliveries. And that number is 068-057-9223. And if anyone would love to contact us for any partnership, they can contact us on that number, as well as on 061-408-1190. But even contacting us on social media, we always respond on any message.
All the best to you, Siva, and your partners. Nice to see a business starting out and not being afraid to grow. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Siva Kabuko, the co-founder of Cloudy Deliveries, joining us for our SME of the Week. Inspired by the SME of the Week, Start your own business or scale up and save up to 50% on fees with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, FSP number 46669. Terms and conditions apply.
If you're running a business, you know this sound. That's growth. Another customer. Money in the bank. Why should your business slow down for your bank? With Capitec Business, it doesn't. You get lower fees, faster credit approvals, and bankers who know your business. Now that's progress. Bank on better with Capitec Business Banking. Capitec is an authorized credit provider. FSP 46669. Initiation, service fees, and conditions apply.
It has gone 7 o'clock. Greg Host is standing by with the latest round of evening news. From my side, good night.